us. Thank you very much. Okay, so you heard from a very clear presentation, English style, and now we're going to go to the American panic. A little bit more of an American style. I don't think I'll be as clear and as well reasoned as David, but I'll try to do my best in communicating what I mean by moral panics over the internet. I realize that from conversations I've tried to stir up before that people differ widely in this room about whether we should panic or what a moral panic is, and I'll try to explain as best I can. It's been, by the way, I'd like to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me, because I've never spoken on this topic, but because I was coming to a conference on information ethics, it just seemed like something that would be fun to talk about and interesting to talk about in this context, and so I'm willing to be instructed about whether I've got this wrong, but it has been useful for me to try to place some of my research in this context of ethics and a moral panic. What people mean, I mean, moral panics have been studied by many people over many years, and this is not a research area of mine. It's a concept I'll borrow. But it generally refers to a disproportionate reaction, okay, an overreaction to something. I've been equally critical of people who dismiss issues. So some of my colleagues are talking about tussles around the information technology. I think tussles minimalizes some of the really serious issues around the internet and so forth. So you can be disproportionate in any degree, but I think it disproportionately worried about things and reacting to it is about a panic. And it's usually about some perceived threat to the moral order. Things are changing. The questions I have which maybe we can return to in discussion, but I'll try to address as best I can, are what's going on? Well, first of all, the typical focus of moral panic used to be around television and the media. It was all about how television's destroying our children's education and our lives and we're being sedentary, etc. And now you hardly hear about television. Somehow television has disappeared and the internet is the villain and it's the focus of real panic. What is overreaction? What I perceive to be an overreaction, some people say, well, they should be panicked. This is really serious. So I think we can debate, is this an overreaction? And I'll try to present some evidence to argue, yes, it's misunderstanding of the realities of what the internet is about. Why? Is it just journalism? Journalists simplify and then exaggerate. Is this simply a function of good journalism that we are panicked about developments, or is it, how can we explain these moral panics? I have some thoughts about that, and I'm particularly, so what? What's the impact of such a moral panic? And I would like to conclude with that, to just tie this into our last discussion, I just think the clear impact is going to be much heavier regulation and over-regulation. There's just no doubt in my mind that this is coming and that this is a quite worrisome trend to me, and we'll debate that. I'll bring in some data. I'm going to try to be data light as much as possible because I know this is not a social science conference. I do appreciate the fact that this is quite interdisciplinary. I've been pleasantly surprised by having a range of disciplines presenting here. But I will, as a social empirical researcher, I'm an inductivist, not a philosopher, but I will I basically look at data and try to make sense of it. A lot of the data, if I present data today, it's going to be mainly from the Oxford Internet Surveys, where we look at Britain and their who uses the internet, who doesn't use it, with what consequences in their daily life and work. And it's based upon field interviews with over 2,000 people in Britain, 14 years old and over. Over every 2 years we do this, and we're just getting ready to go in the field in February, March for the 2011 survey. We can project to as well as anyone to what's going on in Britain, and we're part of the World Internet Project, which has two dozen other countries doing somewhat similar surveys, so that we can always juxtapose our findings with the findings of other countries to ensure that we're not unique in some way. And most of the findings I'll talk about, I think, are shared in other countries. First of all, let me say a bit about a shift in the moral order. I mean, I do think that the internet is transformative, and let me just make two points about that. One is this, the concept I try to use to convey that is that all communication technologies reconfigure access. So they change not only how we do things, but the outcomes of those activities. And I think that is transformative. For example, it changes how we get information, but also what we know. It changes how we communicate with other people, but also who we communicate with. Now that doesn't sound like, and maybe it's not as transformative as the notion of a knowledge society or information society or information age, but I actually think the essence of technological change in communication is changing how we do things and the outcome in these four arenas. Now that's, let me just segue to address this issue of no regulation of the internet. In the very early stages of the development of computing, and it was realized that they didn't know what they were dealing with. In the days of data processing, people put punch cards into computers. And when the very first remote access to mini computers and remote terminals were developed, regulators didn't know what it was. Okay, so if you communicate over a terminal, over a telephone line to a computer in the early days, is it data processing? Well, no, because it's not clearly just data processing any longer. Even though 6,000 computers, everybody was thinking DP, people realize that once you start moving away from the computer, it's something else. Is it a telephone? No, it's not necessarily just telecommunications either. And for that reason, the computer inquiry in the US and subsequent inquiries in many other countries have all thought that actually computer-mediated communication doesn't fit with existing regulatory models. It is not broadcasting. It is not radio. It is not the press. It is not the telephone. And if you apply any of those regulatory models to the internet, you are likely to kill it. And what people decided to do was to try to keep an unregulated arena in order to support the development of a new technology. And it's been very successful because of that, all right? So literally that was a purposeful strategy to enable an arena in which a new technology could develop, which could not develop under current legislation. Take another example, cable television in the US would have never developed if you had enforced copyright. Copyright would have killed it, and in fact, the broadcasters never worried about cable television because they knew copyright legislation would kill it. They could not possibly get the rights to rebroadcast material. But legislation was passed called Must Carry that said anything broadcast must be carried on cable. Totally changed the game. So regulation can kill or support a technology, and be careful before you change regulation to apply some other old technological paradigm to a new technology. But this, the internet, unlike broadcasting, changes the way in which we communicate in fundamental ways. But another technology that did that was the press, all right? And what I'd like to just say, because before I talk about the panics, I'd like to give you my perspective, why I have a very positive perspective on the impact of this transformative power of the internet. I compare the internet with the arrival of the press in the 18th century. I mean, Edmund Burke is credited with first recognizing that the press was a significant independent power in society. Basically, pointing at the reporters' gallery in Parliament and saying, you are the fourth estate. Unlike the commons and the nobility and the clergy, all of a sudden the press, because they could reach millions of people, were all of a sudden a significant power that could compromise and hold accountable the other institutions in society. And to this day, people still speak of the press in liberal democratic societies as a fourth estate that is enabling pluralist democracies to be more pluralistic, more democratic in respect. If you take these, I like to play with taking these feudal estates into the 21st century. And I would say that, you know, the clergy are now the sort of public intellectuals. The nobility has become business and industry economic elites. Commons is more generally government. And the fourth estate remains, well, the press, but journalists and the mass media more generally, including the press. And of course, the mob always exists, and the mob is still around. And we can talk about who's the mob and so forth. But the mob is not the internet. What I'm arguing is that the internet does enable individuals to go to the internet as a source of information independently of any one of the other institutions. So people can get information that can hold government and all other institutions accountable, because they can get information and network with other people online in ways that enable them to have more communicative power relative to other institutions. Now I'll go back to that in a way, but in other words, my bias is that I see a terribly positive impact of the reconfiguring of access enabled by the internet in a liberal democratic society. And I think therefore you have to be very careful with what we do to protect that kind of capability. But let me go to, you know, well, here we, let's talk about some of the panics around the internet. Clearly, people think that the internet is undermining the social order in all sorts of ways. And just a couple of examples of this idea that somehow computers and the internet are destroying social relationships. People are spending time behind a computer rather than talking to people. It's isolating individuals and substituting virtual for real friendship. You talk about, people laugh about having 300 friends or thousands of friends, and you know, this is ridiculous. My wife says I have no friends. but the actual case is that first of all, we've done a lot of research on the impact of the internet on friendship and on social relationships. And there's been numerous studies that have tried to track the relationship between use of the internet, being online, and your patterns of friendship and sociability. Very inconsistent findings. Some people find that, you know, they're quite highly correlated, others that they're negatively correlated. It depends on the context, the people, etc. But if anything is the case, there is no strong relationship. And generally 70% of people in Britain are online. All right? The more average person in Britain is online. And most people use the internet in a way that reinforces their social relationships and also extends it to other people. If there's any impact on sociability, it's generally that people online are as sociable, if not more so, than others. The most people who are not online in Britain tend to say they're more lonely, have fewer friends, etc., and they are but they also are older and more isolated in other ways. So statistically, being online is not associated with being disconnected or isolated. It's not true, all right? It is a myth that generated with the early days of hackers and computer hobbyists when only boys joined computer clubs and put together hobbyist computers and so forth and spent time by themselves or and some gamers. That's not to say that if you want to isolate yourself, you can isolate yourself online. You can isolate yourself with a romance novel. You can isolate yourself with all sorts of things. You can do that online, but most people statistically are more connected. You can see here, look at this, 38% of people in Britain meet somebody online that they did not know before, and many of them go on to meet people offline. So 38% meet somebody online. About a third to a half of those go on to meet that person in physically, all right? We just finished fielding a 17-nation survey of married couples, cohabiting couples, not all married, but cohabiting couples in 17 countries. And if you take those couples, we asked them if they met online. Any guess on what percentage met online? Two? Three? 15%. 15% met their partner online. So even once in a, and I'll tell you that since 2007, when I think the internet had reached a real tipping point, it's become much more prominent in terms of meeting people online that you then go on to meet in person. And well, you can see from our data, but it's verified also in our interviews with married and cohabiting couples, that since 2007, the people who got married from 2007 on are much more likely to have met them. And so it's higher than 15% in terms of that group. So the internet with isolating people? No. It's become a new venue for meeting people, a new way that complements others. What about the information order? Clearly, the panic is that we are destroying the quality of information. We are just creating echo chambers for ourselves and globalized. Because we can communicate anywhere in the world, we are undermining our local communities and local information. It's amazing the degree to which people go online for all sorts of information. Everything we ask about, from sports to medical and health information, is really avidly looked at online by people. If you just look at the far right, you can see finding information about health and medical care. It doubled from 37% to 70% from 2005 to 2007, and it remains very high. And it's even higher because when you consider, when we look at it, it's basically the main person in the household that cares about medical and health of the family. So women are more likely to be looking at this information than boys and men, for example. But it's high. And it's not only in every category of information, you can see over the years, more people are looking online for information about that subject. We ask people who use the internet how important is the internet to your life? And the highest category was it's essential. I call this the sort of Obama effect, where Obama, once he was elected, he couldn't give up his BlackBerry. He didn't know, how do I do anything if I don't have the BlackBerry? Well, many people feel like, well, how did we ever meet anybody in town if you didn't have a mobile phone or something? So it's like, how do we do things? Well, we asked people, and 30% of people in Britain said that the internet was absolutely essential for meeting their needs for information. That is much higher than television, radio, or newspapers. I find that amazing. I was really surprised by that statistic. It's one of the most important statistics I think we got out of the 2009 survey that illustrated that the internet had passed the tipping point in terms of its significance to society. With respect to entertainment, it is not as essential. It is not as essential as talking to other people. thank goodness, and it is not as essential as television for entertainment, but it is more important for entertainment than 16% of people now say that the internet is essential for their entertainment. Also, another question we ask, which I find very interesting, is that we almost didn't ask it because I didn't think anybody would say they go to the internet first. But I said, where would you go first if you were looking for information about different topics? And incredibly, a lot of people go first to the internet before they go to a place, before they talk to a person, before they go to a book, before they go on the telephone. So the first port of call of information is the internet. And 65% say that for a professional school or personal project, the first place they'll go to deal with that is the internet. One of the lowest is if you have problems with a product or a service, you don't first go to the internet. Only 38% first go to the internet. But even there, it's high. Mainly people go telephone somebody if they're having a problem with a service. But in every other case, very high, and not only high in relation to going on the internet, but here you can see over time how it's changing. 2005 to 2009, here's just two examples, planning a trip, information about taxes, both increasing. Every single piece of information we ask about, where's the first place you go? It's the internet, and every 2 years, it is getting higher in terms of the proportion of people that go online. And of course, just to fill in, I'm not showing you the data, but they primarily or increasingly, there's another shift to going to a search engine. So instead of going to a site that you particularly like, you simply go to a Google or another search engine. Or you find increasingly rivaling the search engines are social networking sites. So in Britain now, people spend more time on Facebook than they do on Google or any other site. So Google has now really surpassed in terms of time spent online. And more people are getting referred to news sites and so forth through social networking sites. But this means, again, that in terms of the fifth estate, that people are finding their own sources of information. They're not going to an institution. They're going to the internet. And they are not going to a particular institution online. They're going to search or social networks to go anywhere in the world for the information they need. Now, is it undermining localism? We ask a variety of things about local. Is it just globalizing information? Here's local schools. You'd think if anything, people would actually go visit the school or go to get on the telephone or talk to a neighbor first. But the first place people go to find out information about even local schools is the internet. And in many respects, I just did a paper on the degree to which the localism is the new frontier of the internet. More and more things are moving towards all local information is sort of going online because you really have a critical mass of information online. And, of course, people will say, yes, people are going online, but how can you trust the information that you get online, right? Well, here we ask people how reliable is the information that they get on different media. And you can see on the dark blue is what users of the internet say, and the light blue is what people who don't use the internet say. And people who don't trust the internet are people who've never used the internet, or they've rejected it. Actually, people who used to use the internet and no longer use it are more trusting of the internet than people who've never used it. I'll get back to that. But people who use the internet trust the internet as much as they do broadcast television and more than they do radio or newspapers. And of course, most people who use the internet to read the news also read a newspaper, but they also read the internet beyond that. So they see that as a complement to the news. A general point here is that, and there's a good deal of other research to back it up, is that the internet is an experience technology. Those who are most frightened and panicked and uncertain about the internet are those with the least experience with the internet. So if you find older people and people who have no experience online, they're frightened about the internet. They say, why do I need it? But also at every there are levels of experience gaps. So even social networking sites, the people who are scared about social networking sites are those who have never been on social networking sites. You hear the same things about social networking sites from long-term internet users that you do about the internet from people who've never used the internet. I've gotten along all my life without using this. I'm fine, I don't need to. So same thing for people who've used the email and web all their lives, but or the last 10 years or so, but don't want to get into social networking. If you take that essential character, if you just look at the proportion who view the internet as really very significant or essential for information, you can see over time how much that's risen. That's why I think that the internet has really hit a tipping point. Trust in government continues to hover around 20%. So government regulators, the government regulators, the public does not trust regulators or government. They trust internet service providers more than they do government, and they view that the internet is increasingly significant in their lives. We'll return to this. Now, you've just heard a great talk on privacy, and you're going to hear more after me. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think here is a clear area of genuine panic over social networking sites and the loss of privacy. I think there's a couple of ways. Fumio Shimpo's the video he showed from the European Commission, I think, is priceless, because it's really the music and everything is getting us all as concerned as can be about the privacy online. And I think that's worrisome, because I think it's very possible that, well, first of all, let me give you a sense of, would you believe? This is interesting in a couple of respects. The question was asked about CCTV. Here's, on the right, is our concern over CCTV in the UK in terms of the percent who agree that the CCTV is a threat to personal privacy. Only about 40% in Britain do, and the UK is the most saturated with surveillance cameras than any other country in the world, I think. I think there's a camera for every 14 people or something in that order. Okay, but let's see what we ask also people who use the is the present use of computers and the internet a threat to personal privacy? This is a question that's been asked since the 1950s, 60s, and it's declined. All right, it's very interesting. So while everybody's panicking about Facebook, mainly people who never use Facebook, but parents or regulators, most people regard privacy as less of a threat than they did earlier. And it'll be very interesting in 2011. I would think it's got to be higher because of the journalistic coverage of these issues. But clearly, there's a decline in the proportion of people who are worried about the privacy threats of the internet. I think there's a couple of things that clearly, we're in a period of transition. As David said, this is a huge difference between 6,000 computers, and now we have, 2 billion users of the internet across the world. 70% of Britons have a computer in their home, at least one, and many have more than one. So that this is a totally different regime, It's not data processing, and it's not that created in the era of data processing. And there are different expectations, and I think one way of looking at this, I view it very optimistically, as the fact that now children and people who use social networking sites and the internet expect to have more control over who sees what about whom. So the idea that you can say, I think my family should not see this, or my friends should see that, or this should be public, is great, because that all, and now it's not as always easy to use as it should be, and it will get easier to control your privacy, but I think there'll be more and more of an expectation that people control their privacy online have as much control as they do in real life, all right? Of course, in real life, you know, who's the primary person who violates your privacy in everyday life? Government data processing or? Well, your family. Family is usually when you say, has somebody violated your personal privacy? And this was in decades of research, pretty consistent. And you say yes, and they say, who was that? And it's your family or someone tells somebody how much you make or how old you are or whatever, and it's you don't like that. But it's usually not Google or the. But anyway, there could be a greater expectation of personal control over privacy, and I think you mentioned Victor Mayer Schoenberger's work on delete. The idea that you could even decide, oh, I don't like that picture of myself from 5 years ago. I would like to remove that from the internet. The idea that we can start selectively forgetting is somewhat scary to me, sort of Orwellian. But the idea that you could expect to be able to start controlling more what's available about you online is important. Okay, let me wind up with wind up on this. Not privacy, but secrecy and confidentiality, and say a little bit about WikiLeaks, because I think we've discussed it a tiny bit in a number of talks, but hopefully we can discuss it more. To me, this is, here are a couple of examples of real moral panic raising. Here's an online poll that was fielded a few days ago. Here's a right of center Asymmetric Threats Contingency Alliance. This is D.K. Matai, and he asked the people on his sites, WikiLeaks, do you think that the daily barrage of new revelations has far-reaching consequences for global governance and humanity? Well, come on. But anyway, 56% of people who read his site and voted on this, maybe there were 8 or 10, but anyway, a lot of people he emails, 56% said yes. Okay, but anyway, this kind of stuff stirs moral panic, like, oh my God, the humanity is in the sink because of WikiLeaks. Okay, but on the left, here we have John Perry Barlow. Well, this is actually the, this is from the Freedom Forum. The Freedom Forum, I think, is voting this, and I left out the site. But the first serious info war is now engaged. The field of battle is WikiLeaks, and John Perry Barlow is quoted, who said information wants to be free. And anyway, so on right and left, people are panicked about WikiLeaks and raising quite serious concerns over it. Because I view the Fifth Estate as a very positive development, I was both impressed because it really illustrated the power of information and the potential for accountability of information. At the same time, I was worried because it could undermine the very kind of virtues that it could undermine the support for the kind of Fifth Estate, the idea that anybody can post anything without thought. I thought the most useful thing to do is, my biggest concern with the discussion of WikiLeaks is that people oversimplify. Again, this is what the press does, simplify and exaggerate. And I think academics should be unsimplifying, should be decomposing and clarifying and moderating some of these ideas. But these are all the ethical choice points. There's not anything like whether WikiLeaks is right or wrong. I would think an ethicist would want to look at all of these issues, like the U.S. Army intelligence analyst who leaked the files. The An Australian politician basically blamed the U.S. government for WikiLeaks. He said WikiLeaks should not be to blame for anything. It's the U.S. government that leaked this information. I agree. Another was nobody identifies their source. And he was not identified by WikiLeaks. He was not identified by the press. He was identified by a hacker to the U.S. government. Okay, so that's another ethical issue about whether this hacker should have identified the source of these leaks. The charges in Sweden against Assange. I have no idea, but I understand from discussions I've had with a couple of journalists that they are credible charges, although when I read them, they seem stretched. But I don't, but those are a separate matter that has nothing to do with his the WikiLeaks itself. But what WikiLeaks did in accepting leaked material, redacting it to some degree, and distributing it is no different than what the press has done. And in fact, the press, they are working with a consortium of The Guardian, The New York Times, and other newspapers to get this material out. If the press had not reported this, most people would not know anything about WikiLeaks and these leaks. But no one has accused the press of irresponsible release of information. But they're working in collaboration. Of course, there's also the ethics of the takedown. Who is trying to take down WikiLeaks? And then there's the efforts of companies trying to take down and hurt companies that have abandoned or not supported WikiLeaks. So this is getting more and more interesting, as we were saying later, because there are all of these issues over WikiLeaks. But I think to take WikiLeaks as an example of the need for regulation is actually misplaced, because it's basing this on a real panic about a very oversimplified view of what WikiLeaks did. We could talk about many other things, from artificial companions to children and the internet. People are so panicked about children and the internet. In Britain, most classrooms have no access to the internet. One of the greatest educational technologies ever has no accessibility from classrooms, because one of my colleagues called her son's school and said, we wanted to say, could I ask about the internet? And before she could even explain, the principal said, oh, don't worry, kids can't get any access to the internet from our school. This is what panic causes. Why the panic? I think, clearly people have deterministic views about technology, that we're losing control, that technology is going to rip through society in ways that we can't control. I think anything new is always a source of panic, and people don't have experience with it, so I'd advise everybody, I'm always advising people, and especially regulators and politicians, to use this stuff so that they have some better personal sense of what's going on. And that it's past the tipping point, it's become essential, and as the internet is no longer an innovation and it becomes more essential to our everyday life, I suppose people are more worried about it. But I also think it's just not enough systematic empirical research about this, and that we really need multidisciplinary systematic research to clarify what is actually happening and not what the press is saying about. But I think it is undermining. It could undermine the Fifth Estate. It could have a chilling effect on freedom of expression. The privacy and data protection were designed to enable sharing of information. The whole idea behind it, the intent, was in part to enable sharing of information by clarifying what are the rules. Now it has the exact opposite effect, because the rules are not clear, and they're quite overly restrictive now, as from David's presentation, I think. So I think you have the real risk of undermining the role of the internet in political, economic, and social development. I'm not saying we should trivialize it, but I think that we should treat it as a serious issues for research and debate. And I'll end with this. Here's that statistic about the growing significance of the internet. And that green line is, we ask people, should government regulate the internet more? And I find this terribly worrisome, in that it's moved from 17% of people who thinks the internet should be regulated more to almost 50%. And I imagine when we go out in the field in 2011, it'll be even higher because of the scare stories about the internet and its ethical, the moral panic around the internet. Okay, thank you, and hopefully I have time for questions.